Welcome to Horrorspiria. My name is May, and today we have a very special guest. We've spoken about him many times on the pod. Me and Clinton visited his business last year for my birthday. I've told my students so many times about here, and they visit as well. So you're kind of like a little bit famous.
Oh my gosh.
in my world. But we're going to talk about that, but first let me just go ahead and introduce them. Everyone, welcome Eric Allen Hatch.
Thank you for having me.
Yes. So I have bragged about you a lot, like as if you're one of my best friends. And I'm just like this creepy person. But I mean, I guess for people that don't know too much about you, can you please tell them what you do?
Yeah. I mean, I wear a lot of different hats right now. And so it's possible people might be familiar with what I do from a couple different angles. Career-wise, I was primarily a film programmer for about 10 years. I was at Maryland Film Festival and was the director of programming there for a number of years. And then I quit suddenly and wrote an angry article about my experience there that a lot of people read in Filmmaker magazine. During that period, I also do a lot of memes on Twitter and Instagram that some people know for me. And now professionally, it's a frothy mix of film criticism, music management of sorts. I'm basically managing the musician Dan Deacon with the musician Dan Deacon, kind of DIYing everything he does. Yeah. And that intersects with film a lot as well, because he is very actively film scoring right now. And then, you know, my baby here, Beyond Video, does not result in any financial compensation. It's all volunteer gig, but I'm here a good 20 to 30 hours a week, both public facing and also just making sure that this video store culture is taken into the future here in Baltimore in a way that's sustainable.
You know, it's funny that you mentioned the memes thing, because that's actually how I first found you.
Oh, yeah?
I can tell you exactly when it was. It was when Uncut Gems came out.
Okay.
And Uncut Gems was my favorite movie, and whenever that it came out, 2019, right? And I think you went viral on Twitter, or like you created a Twitter moment or something. And I was like, oh my God, this dude is hilarious. And so I started following you, and it took me like a month before I realized that you were local.
Yeah.
And I got so stoked about it. And around that time was when Beyond Video also came into fruition, right?
Let's see. So I'm trying to piece those two time, well, I guess three, you know, where did the timelines of memes, Uncut Gems, and Beyond Video intersect?
I feel like it happened all at once.
Yeah. I mean, Beyond Video opened publicly in late 2018.
Right.
So yeah. just had our 2-year anniversary that we marked with a global pandemic and no activity other than cautiously opening our doors on weekends. But Uncut Gems, yeah, I mean, it doesn't exactly answer your question because I don't know the timeline perfectly. But it's funny, like the memes are kind of recreational for me, and it's been a mixed blessing that in some ways they've boosted my profile any more than any of the rigorous work I've done. After I quit 11 years at Maryland Film Festival and the whole time had wanted to attend Rotterdam, International Film Festival Rotterdam, quit and got an invitation to do an artist talk about my memes at that festival, you know, which was awesome. But also, like, you know, at sometimes I can feel a bit like, you know, a court jester in identity when, like, I quit my job that has been like life defining. And then everyone's just like, oh, that meme got, you know, 10,000 retweets or whatever. It's like, I wish my work got 10,000 retweets.
Oh my gosh.
But yeah, I mean, I think the reason I took it in that direction with your question about Uncut Gems is that I feel like, to me, that still feels very recent. And I think I had a moment where I was like, maybe I'm done with Twitter and that kind of thing. And Uncut Gems memes kind of revived my energy. So for you, it was like a moment of discovering that there was this guy locally who doesn't have a career and is a court jester on Twitter. And for me, it was like, I guess I'm doing this again. But it was, you know, That's mischaracterizing it, because it was fun again for a window there.
No. What I was going to say is that, like, I definitely know where you're coming from. And as I got to know you better as a friend, I was like, holy shit, like, Eric has, like, done a lot of, like, real stuff and not just, like, shit posting on the internet. Like, this is absurd. So I definitely understand that, especially because I think that you've done so much important work as a local artist in this area. But I also can tell you that, like, being funny and topical and kind of the moment is very rare. Like, it really is. And I actually even use your memes to help connect ideas in my horror class, especially. And I guess we're horror podcasts, even though I don't know what that means anymore. But yeah, no, I always was so impressed with your wit, but I think, like, it was almost like digging into a treasure chest when I found out that you had Beyond Video, because you don't know this, I think, but the whole reason why I'm, I guess, in the industry, whatever, so to speak, is because of video rental stores. And it's something that I deeply miss. And, like, when I read how it works and everything, I was just like, this is, like, why don't people do this more? And so I just think it's so impressive. So I guess we can first start talking about Beyond Video. So I guess tell people, what is Beyond Video?
Yeah, so Beyond Video is, if you come in the space as we are now recording it, it looks like an old school video store. And even though it's only been open to the public for about 2 years, I think as you explore the space, it feels like an old one that somehow survived. You know, it just kind of has that.
It does.
DIY, you know, mom and pop business vibe. We're in a row house here in Baltimore, and basically, a lot of us who were involved in this project used to either work or regularly shop or both at a store called Video American. It was the Baltimore video store. You can actually see it in John Waters' movie Serial Mom, and John was a regular there. Really special place. Embodied everything that's special about a cultural space, whether it's a record store, bookstore, or video store, where everyone's there because they love one thing, everyone's exchanging information and taste, and you know, it feels fun, it feels social, and it feels edifying. So when Video American, which was actually owned by a guy in Delaware, and it was becoming a schlep as he got older and as returns diminished for him to keep doing that.
Yeah.
We tried initially, the people here behind Beyond Video, to save Video American as a thing and just preserve that space, the collection, and turn it into a nonprofit. But for various reasons, that didn't work out. And so we sort of retreated, licked our wounds, and started building another collection from scratch. And the result, and all along, we hoped to find an ideal space like this where we could recreate the video store with the twist that it's a nonprofit. And I use video store to describe it to people, but really what it is a community library of movies.
Right.
People pay only a one-time a month membership fee. Most people are paying $12 a month for their plan. And then there's no rental fees, no late fees. It's just a library other than that one exchange of money a year. And, you know, we opened with about 9,000 movies, and we're up doubled that now. We're a little over 18,000.
Yeah, for people that have not been able to visit, I mean, now it's even grown more since the last time I visited. The last time I visited was almost a year ago now, but it's literally like floor to ceiling, you know, discs. And it's not even like, sometimes you have the original cases, but you have so many videos or so many discs that they're in like these smaller cases. And it's just like, it's so magical.
Yeah. So we're in the inventory area back here. Oh. So when you're seeing the display case, those are all things that are checked out that the customer has brought forward, because we're in a three-story row house, and two of the stories, one is a dank basement that shouldn't be spoken of, let alone ventured into. But upstairs, there's just lots of shopping area, including a whole room that's organized by director. There's a couple hundred directors highlighted, obviously foreign, classics, cult, horror, all those good things. And so, yeah, I mean, that's one of the challenges is having an, you know, having a great collection is one thing, but having a space large enough and organized in a way that's appealing, but also has some things faced out, isn't completely crammed and overflowing and bookended. As the collection grows, that becomes more and more of a challenge of, you know, how do we, back in this space here, you know, keep everything very well organized so nothing gets lost, and then upstairs make it kind of a cornucopia that people can explore.
And I mean, it's just beautiful, especially as, you know, you and I are film people, but I bet that, I mean, you service pretty much the entire, you service the Baltimore area. Have you ever had people further out from this area sign up?
Yeah, we have. I mean, a part of our thinking in opening this was that people might come from a distance, because people always did to Video American back in the day. I mean, I was one of those people. You know, I grew up in the suburbs between DC and Baltimore. And when I really caught the movie bug, friends and I would come up to Video American, and eventually I just gave up and started working there, and it's, you know, largely redirected my life. But we hoped, and there have been some people. I mean, there's a guy similar to us trying to nail down this recording. There's a guy who was just emailing to me today, like, he lives in DC proper, and he's like, I don't think I'm going to be able to return my videos this week. Like, there's a coup going on and I don't feel safe. So
yeah.
We have 2 weeks rental period for the back catalog titles, which is the bulk of the store. So, you know, there are people who drive 45 minutes or an hour from the rural Pennsylvania even to come.
Really?
Yeah. I mean, you know, up 83, it's just about half an hour to get into Pennsylvania. So
I still don't have geography figured out up here, because I'm from Florida, basically. And so when you say rural Pennsylvania, I'm just like, oh, that must be like 6 hours away.
That's what I'm hoping. Everyone's jaw is going to drop that people come from such a, you know, bucolic area to...
Bucolic. That's an incredible use of bucolic. I love it. Okay. Yeah. But I guess, like, you know, with how special this place is and how beautiful it is, you would hope that it's easier to replicate. But I know that even getting beyond video setup was like a 10-year process for you, right?
So more like 5 or 6, but many years. And I mean, to put that in context, I think that the first couple years were, you know, Video American, that prior store I mentioned, had 6 locations originally, 2 in Delaware, 2 in DC, and 2 in Baltimore. And as they started kind of closing one by one, the genesis of this around probably, I'm guessing, 2014-15 was us trying to save one of those. It almost didn't matter which one, because each of them had existed for more than a decade. The oldest one had been about 25 years, and we're like, these collections can't be lost. We got to save one. So I think from realizing we utterly failed in that and had to just start from scratch was probably about 2015-16, and then opened our doors in 2018. So don't get me wrong, there were many times where it felt like it wasn't going to happen, and we had put a lot of time and money and effort into you know, trying to save something that people didn't want. You know, that was the fear.
I mean, even your space, I know that, I think I read this in one of your interviews, that like you just kind of got lucky with the space, and it's a beautiful space. It's huge, but I think you said once that you have like subsidized rent or something like that.
Well, we're in a different situation now, but initially, so where we are is on Howard Street in Baltimore, and two doors down is the Auto Bar, which is, if you're DC oriented, it's kind of like the Black Cat, a little smaller, but it's the closest equivalent we have to that. And our initial landlord in this space was the owner of the Auto Bar. So there's the Auto Bar two doors down. In between is a row house that's the green room for the Auto Bar, basically. And then there's this. And I might be mischaracterizing this, but I think he basically bought this house to be a buffer between him and the residential area and the rest of the street. And it was kind of just...
So this is a house.
Yeah, this historically was a row house, but it's been decades, I think, since it was occupied in that way. There was a long-standing many location, well, one location at a time, but itinerant, I guess, sort of punk death black metal record store called Reptilian Records. That was a big part of Baltimore's underground for a long time. And this was the last iteration of that, probably closing around 2013 or so, I would guess. So when, and his store was just upstairs, on this main street level area. And then upstairs was pentagrams and ceilingless areas and just, you know, the debris of years of, you know, punk and metal mania. So a big part of opening this space was like DIY, like flooring and ceiling work and building all the storage shelves, obviously, and just making it a safe and organized space.
Yeah. And I mean, you couldn't tell because it looks, it's so organized in here, even amidst the like really beautiful organized chaos. It's just really well kept. So what was probably like the most difficult part in trying to put Beyond Video together?
I think because it was a long haul, I think kind of just keeping the faith. I don't mean to be corny, but
no, it's true.
When we didn't have a space and when the collection was spread out between all of the collect, you know, we're collectively owned, and at times it was just boxes and boxes in each of our apartments, not particularly well organized. You know, we were getting together at times trying to get a sense of what we had and what we didn't have. And obviously when that's mixed in with the debris of our own living spaces and spread out among five or six of us, it just felt really chaotic. And we had a clear vision, but it wasn't until, you know, the landlord of the auto bar and us were connected and we landed in this space that we really had the vision and focus, because it allowed us to bring everything into one space. You know, no matter how many spreadsheets we had of our inventory, we didn't realize what a great collection we had until we laid it out here and realized, oh, you know, we're not as comprehensive as Video American, but we're in the ballpark. You know, when we opened, we felt that way, and then we've doubled since then. So, but yeah, just being in the physical space, knowing we had a landlord, you referenced earlier that wasn't exactly subsidized rent, but he hadn't had this place occupied since that record store had left, which had been a few years. So during the time that he was our landlord, we were definitely below market value. There were a few months as we were getting set up where we weren't charged at all. And, you know, without him having wanted to see this project come to fruition, it probably wouldn't have. So,
yeah, no, that's remarkable. What has kind of been like the most surprising thing for you as you've run the store? Like, were you ever worried that people wouldn't care?
Yeah, we were very worried. I mean, the most heartening early sign that people were going to respond was we did a Kickstarter. And this was prior to opening, but when we had this space, we took the leap of committing to rent this space before we did the Kickstarter, which was for about $30,000, all of which was just spent really on making the space ready and having a little bit left over to build the collection and fall back on. But during that time, we very intentionally did Kickstarter rather than another crowdsourcing, because we needed it to be binary. We didn't want to get $8,000 from the few weirdos, you know, who were willing to support a video store in 2020 and then try to open a video store with that little amount of money. It would have just been depressing to know so few people wanted it and we wouldn't have had enough money to do it. And but we did make our money, and that was the first sign of like, okay, maybe we're onto something here. We're not in our own delusional bubble. And, you know, once we've opened, the response has been almost overwhelming. You know, I think a big part of it is because we donate the labor. So that allows us the collection to grow at a rate it wouldn't be growing if it was a for profit. But during COVID, you know, our hours have shrunk to just Saturdays and Sundays. And even in this cold weather, or even sometimes in rainy weather, like there's a line to get in because we're just letting a few people in the store at a time to shop. And not only is there a line to get in, but people are like happy excited to be in the space after like 10 or 15 minutes waiting out in like, you know, freezing rain or whatever they've endured to get in here during this pandemic. And just the, not just has it been heartening that people come in, but it's been heartening what they rent. Almost all the rentals come off the director's wall or foreign or classic sections upstairs, maybe the cult or LGBTQ section. Our new releases, which we have, are a fraction of the business. And that's a shift. In the waning days of Video Americaine about 10 years ago, basically the store was being kept alive by like new releases and porn, you know? And so I'm getting at the biggest fear I had, which was maybe that we would open this project, maybe it would last a year or two, but the things I really cared about, the world cinema and the, you know, this archive, for lack of a better word, of, you know, 100 years of history, would not be fully accessed.
Right. And I think that's sort of what not only has made us closer as friends, but something that I think is more beautiful about Beyond Video than, say, so for me in Florida and Puerto Rico, there wasn't like a cool video store. It was Blockbuster in both of those, actually. But the block, it was like Blockbuster in the late 90s, and my Blockbuster stocked a bunch of weird foreign films. Yeah. And that's how I got into movies. And that's the kind of beautiful thing about Beyond Video here. You don't discriminate against larger movies, but it's more impressive to see all of the quote unquote weirder stuff. And I think, you know, you might have said this before, or maybe it's just an observation I've had. It's just kind of like, especially in 2020, it's like a streamer fatigue, right?
Yeah. I mean, I used that a lot when I was pitching the project before opening, and it's been, you know, very
and
much
that
validated.
Was in 2014, right?
Yeah. Yeah. I mean,
it was like before
it really set in. I mean, yeah. And COVID has really underscored that. But I mean, even when you remove it from being streaming specific, it's an online fatigue, right? Like, to me, reading a book or putting on a vinyl record or something, regardless of the debates about what format is best or which is most convenient, it's relaxing in a way the internet can never be, because, right, you know, our work, our lives, we're you know, just mind merging with these devices constantly. Our eyes are being assaulted by them constantly. And don't get me wrong, they're amazing, life-changing things, computers and these phones and stuff. Obviously, I'm a memer. I can't hate them completely. But anytime I can not have them in my line of vision and being focused on something else that's immersive feels like a vacation.
Yeah.
And so, yeah, but shopping here, someone's returning some videos through our mail slot. Shopping
Thank
here
you.
is pleasurable, whereas browsing in a online space, I think, is exhausting. You know,
oh, yeah.
If you're on Netflix, even if you're on a great service like Canopy or Criterion, you're yeah. scrolling, and we spend our whole lives scrolling. Whereas here, maybe you're with a partner or a friend, maybe you're by yourself, you're reading boxes, there are physical objects.
It was an experience, you know.
Yeah.
I didn't have the happiest childhood, but I knew that when we would go to the rental store, we could be there for an hour, and you only end up with two movies at the end of it. But you know, you scour through it, and I'm trying not to make it sound like old hags, even though I'm very proud to be one. But it really does just remind you that films aren't just these things that are dropped in a cloud.
Right.
Which is definitely the way that the industry seems to be moving towards. And I don't think either of us are even anti-streaming, but it's there should be a space for both, especially with, you know, all these debates about, you know, oh, will movie theaters go away with, you know, same day premieres and whatnot. And both of us are also really huge supporters of theaters. It's nice just to have the option. Yeah, I know one thing that you said, I think you said this in an email, was that in 2020, Beyond Video has kind of thrived, right, with the pandemic?
Yeah, I mean, I think if we were open normal hours, maybe we would have, you know, we would have COVID basically, because we're trying to be very, you know, careful and responsible about how we use this space. But to connect it to what we were just talking about, no year has laid bare the shortcomings of streaming more than 2020. Mm-hmm. I mean, even a casual movie or series viewer has probably run into something they just absolutely can't find on the internet. You know, so the lie that the internet would have everything available to us at a click of a button, 2020 has exposed. Mm-hmm. And also, we're seeing the fragmenting across so many different services. Who hasn't realized, oh my God, I have, you know, I have to add another streaming service if I want to access this content, or I want to watch The Invisible Man, or I want to watch First Cow, but right now it's $14.99 or whatever. The monetization of streaming is changing as theaters are closed for Hollywood to try to keep capturing that money from us. Whereas in a library situation like this, you know, a film, whether, you know, Tenet costs, you know, just, you know, your $12 membership fee allows you to rent Tenet and infinite other movies where you might spend $20 just watching that online. Right. So, yeah, it's been a affirming year for the project for sure.
And that's great. I remember I wanted to do this actually when I first visited last year, but my birthday falls around the time of when the pandemic started. And I don't think I ever told you this because it's kind of a rude thought, but I was like, oh my God, is it going to go away now? So I'm so glad that it's been able to, and in a way, as you said, it really just kind of makes sense to me. People are now at home. And I think a lot of things that we took for granted before, like physical media, you know, or, you know, sharing time with people, has really come into stark contrast.
I should add too that, you know, we survived also because of our business model and because of the, you know, generosity and support of our members, because like any business, other than essential businesses, there was 2 months where we were closed. We had to be closed. And that would have been really tough on us if we depended on a la carte rentals. But with the $12 or $20 a month rental fee, a lot of people were kind and just paid it for those 2 months. So not only were we not taking a loss, we still had income during the worst of, you know, being shut down.
No, and that's really beautiful. Another article that you put up once is kind of like a how to do Beyond Video elsewhere.
Yeah.
That I think was really beautiful because, as you say, this is not, you know, everyone that is participating in this does it because of the love of the culture, which if I lived closer, I could easily see myself doing that. I live like 90 minutes away. Yeah. But I think, like, can you sort of speak to that, like how feasible you think perhaps replicating something like this elsewhere is?
I think it's very doable. I mean, you just need a few, you know, insane maniacs who are willing to work for free, you know, and are really dedicated to it happening. Because really the people and the drive to make it happen could happen in almost any place, no matter how expensive. I mean, in Baltimore, we have about 400, 500 members at a time who are paying their fees. And that's
a lot.
It's a lot. But also, like, maybe wouldn't feel like that much in LA or New York, right?
Right.
You know, where rent is nuts. But there's more people there, luckily. So you proportionally could probably make it work even in those cities. But anywhere else, any other college town, or, you know, even mid-sized urban area like Baltimore, there's probably enough movie lovers who are not being well served and miss video stores. Or, you know, so we tend to have some older clientele who never really got accustomed to streaming, or knew right away it doesn't meet their needs. But The other encouraging, surprising, whatever thing that came out of this project is probably most of our customers are in their 20s or early 30s.
Right.
And some of those are people who never really went to a video store or a great video store at this point.
I know. It kind of blows my mind. I teach that age, like the young 20s especially, and sometimes like they'll tell me the craziest things like, Miss, I didn't realize that Nick Cannon didn't find Nickelodeons. And I'm like, oh, okay.
Yeah.
So that actually is really affirming.
Yeah, yeah. And so that it would be one of my main points of encouragement for people trying to do it elsewhere is it's not like you'd be catering to a dying business model with a dying customer base.
Right.
There's actually young people who are, you know, really hungry for cinema. And know that even not during COVID, even during, you know, if you have five great repertory theaters in your city, which what city does,
right.
There's infinite movies, you know, from every era and every genre, and every region that you might want to access. And right. You might not want to wait till that time that special theater near you actually finds a print and is able to show it. You might want to walk down the street and have it in your hand in 10 minutes.
Yeah, no, absolutely. It's so well said. So you might have expected me to ask you this, so I'm going to ask you it. And if you didn't, then I'm sorry.
Oh.
But you have to tell me, you're like, I love this siren in the background. It's so beautiful. You have to tell me your like first experience at a video store that you like have in your heart. Can you like speak to that?
Yeah, I mean, I'm trying to remember... I think that the first one that really felt special to me probably was also at a chain video store. I think it would have been Errol's Video, which later got bought by Blockbuster. You know, so it was sort of one of, as video stores were heading towards chains in the like late 80s or so.
Yeah.
That was a Maryland-based one, I believe, or at least a regional one. But me and my friend Evan, who's now a musicologist, who just wrote a book about race and punk in America.
Oh, that's nice. What is it called?
You're putting me on the spot. What is it called?
I want to read it.
I have a copy that I haven't read yet. It just got published in the last month.
Cool.
So that's my escape pod there. But his name is Evan Rapport, and I know the book's awesome because he's awesome.
Okay.
But at like 10 or 11 years old, yeah. We found Stop Making Sense at the video store. And, you know, Talking Heads were one of the bands that we had bonded over. And
oh, that's so nice.
Yeah. And just that crystallized for me. I mean, we rented a lot of great movies before, but the way, even in a kind of bland suburban area, a video store, bookstore, record store can take you to, you know, New York in 1982 or whatever cultural place you want to be that's more vibrant and exciting than where you are in your physical space. That's when I realized that video stores were these portals.
Yeah, absolutely. I think mine, similar to you in a way, though that your example makes me realize that music DVDs just aren't really a thing anymore.
Yeah, we have a big section over here, which luckily, you know, Baltimore's such a music city that it does rent pretty actively. But Stop Making Sense, I think, you know, is perhaps disproportionately remembered because Jonathan Demme made it and it's just, you know, it's so exquisite. But yeah, I mean, that I think, you know, the new model is like something like Lemonade, right? It's like the video album.
Right.
Has kind of replaced.
Or, you know, Sturgill Simpson actually just did that anime for Netflix.
Yeah.
For his, and that was actually really good.
You know, I have heard and enjoyed the album. I actually haven't sat down and watched the animation. How have I heard it and not watched it?
No, I know. It's just, it's funny. That was probably one of my favorite releases that year.
Yeah.
Before I get into my recollection, because it kind of connects to yours, you mentioned something that I have to ask you, because me and Clinton, who usually do the podcast with, we have a debate about this. So, you know, I think one reason Beyond Video will probably thrive for a long time and hopefully for the rest of our lives, amen, is that Baltimore is such an artistic city.
Yeah.
And, you know, I've only been in this DC area for about 2 years, and I can hands down tell you, like, Baltimore has the best food. Baltimore has the coolest people. I feel like I feel a strong kinship here. And I can see why Beyond Video works here. And I remember one time I made a comment like, well, you know, we should work in DC too. And Clinton looked at me like, no, like people in DC don't care about this. What is your opinion on that take?
I think it could work in DC. I mean, DC, like I referred to earlier, DC was a place of wonder for me when I was a kid. I mean, that was like, you know, for whether it was like punk or, you know, any kind of culture I was trying to access, driving to DC felt like I just couldn't believe I was close to it. And I felt like I was in the epicenter of something. And obviously, it's become an extremely gentrified place now. And yeah. Even before Trump, it kind of had this plasticity and soullessness to it that was occupying a lot of the downtown core. But, I mean, you have things like Sun Cinema, the micro cinema.
Yeah, yeah.
Which I see as a very, you know, kindred project to Beyond Video.
It's yeah, yeah. They're couple, very punk.
Yeah, love totally. Love the whole thing. Totally. And even though they're younger folk, they, to me, carry on the spirit of what DC used to feel like to me.
Yeah.
And I was really heartened to see that. And I could see, you know, it shows that they can, if they're willing to put in the labor, make a DIY space still work in DC that's dedicated to the arts. So
I'll lead up this charge and we can call it Beyond Video. Is DC south or north?
Say again.
Where is DC in relation to here?
Oh, you really don't know geography.
I really don't know.
You are currently north of DC.
So Maryland is above DC? Where's Virginia?
So DC was carved out of Virginia and Maryland.
Okay.
Yeah. So you can be in parts of Maryland and be south of DC because of the odd shape of Maryland. Maryland's kind of shaped like a pterodactyl or something. And it has, you know, the bay separates it into, you know.
The water here is so beautiful. Like, not literally, but but the like the way that the city's built around the water is so gorgeous to me.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, it was a city that kind of grew organically as a really active harbor, you know, for trade. Yeah. And even though that's diminished quite a bit, the way it was laid out, it retains some of that historic flavor.
Yeah, no, it's really, and the Wire is helping me as I go through as well.
Is this your first time watching The Wire? Or?
Yeah, I've never watched Wire before. I just finished season one. I'm in halfway through season two, and probably like other than me being like, I think I vaguely recognize that. I'm like, holy crap, there's a lot of actors.
Yeah, well, also just as an aside, I mean, seasons three and four are, you know, some of the best seasons of television ever. So
yeah. Okay. I'm working there.
Yeah. That's okay. You got a lot of good stuff ahead of you.
If anything, as I'm watching, other than I feel like all the non-white actors are amazing, I'm also like, what did Dominic West do with this? Like Dominic West do with his life?
Yeah. Since this? Or
no, I think he got like an affair with a star. Did you hear about that?
I haven't. I'm not too tuned into his personal life, but I'd love to hear about it. Let's keep going.
It was like a whole thing. So to kind of backtrack to the, you know, your first video store experience, I love that you said that thing about the portal, because even in my little, for more context, I grew up between Orlando and Puerto Rico, but weirdly enough, both neighborhoods where I grew up in were not part of the like metro area. Mm-hmm. We were always a bit. So in Florida, it was actually like a Puerto Rican enclave or enclave. I don't know. I speak too many languages. I don't know how to pronounce it. And so I remember that like my first memory would be actually with A Tale of Two Sisters, mm-hmm. The Korean horror.
Yeah.
And I remember being like, I was probably 11, but I was like, oh my gosh, they make horror movies in other languages?
That's yeah,
crazy.
Right.
And that started an obsession with Asian horror. And now what I'm most known for is being a genre cinema theorist and based in foreign cinema. And that I truly don't think that wouldn't have happened if it hadn't been for video stores. And so one thing that, as we were talking about this podcast, was talking about horror home video.
Yeah.
And stuff like that. And that's sort of where that all stems from. So I guess let's talk a little bit about that. Yeah.
Yeah. And that kind of as a tangent, but maybe a good way to set that up. That was such an exciting moment. I mean, Two Sisters, I want to say it was around 2001, 2002.
Yeah. Fun fact.
Yeah.
A Korean movie had not been screened in American theaters until that movie.
So.
And that's 2001.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, we're getting really random here, but just a few blocks from here, there was a Korean businessman who tried to open a Korean first-run theater here around that time, actually earlier than that. And he succeeded in showing two movies, one of which was Tell Me Something, the Korean thriller. The second was Attack the Gas Station, which, do you know that film?
I actually don't.
It kind of is diminishing returns as you go along, but the first 10 minutes are... these guys with like hockey clubs who just run up on a gas station and beat the shit out of it. And then
sounds Korean.
Then they get noodles together and yeah. They're like kind of depressed. And they're like, well, we attacked the gas station. What should we do now? You know, after we finish these noodles. And one of them's like, do you want to just do it again? And then they just run and just beat the shit out of the gas station again. Then there's a story and the movie goes downhill from there. But anyway, I was able to see those
just gas stations.
Yeah. I was able to see Tell Me Something and Attack the Gas Station along with like six or seven Korean people in a movie theater in like
amazing.
99 or so.
Yeah.
And then a bullshit neighborhood complaint that said there were going to be too many. It was going to cause like traffic and parking problems. Shut down that theater, which
that's
was fucked up. Brutal.
No, that's amazing. I love hearing stories like that because especially so in Orlando, like it's soulless. I'm so proud of where I'm from, but I feel like the fact that I grew up in like a Disney, you know, like gift shops around the corner instead of like theaters had an effect on me. So like I really love hearing stories like that, like even like this Korean first run theater, like I can't even
imagine.
Isn't
Orlando kind of like Hollywood in a way where it's like it's their, you know, people's imagination is this one thing like Disney, but then it's actually kind of like has a sleazy underbelly? Or am I
actually
being wishful thinking there?
I always say it's Vegas.
Oh, okay.
I really love Vegas and I don't gamble. I don't drink. But every single time I visited Vegas like 3 times, and mainly because Vegas is actually I once did the budgeting. It's the cheapest desert to get to from the East Coast. Like it's just so cheap to go there. But the thing is like, once you leave the strip, you're just like, it's not like Vegas per se is poor. But it's not like there's anything other than the aftermath of its capitalism, you know, and I feel like that is really obvious in places like there and places like Orlando. Mm-hmm. So Orlando does have like basically we call it kind of like the strip. And then outside of that are all of the neighborhoods with the brown and black workers.
Yeah.
So like, you know, and then we would never have mom and pop stores. We would just have like these dilapidated versions of like franchises where even the franchises almost felt like I didn't even realize Blockbuster was a chain until like
right.
I was like 15. So horror home video. It was just such a good question.
No, I liked that. I liked that aside because I actually am fond of Las Vegas myself, although
I really love Vegas. Yeah.
I think that my memory, I'm really like, I liked it in the 90s, and I'm not romanticizing the Vegas past because I don't necessarily feel like I accessed that. It was more that, again, like you, I don't have a gambling problem. So in the 90s, Vegas had like 24-hour, there was one of everything that was open 24 hours. So in like 3 a.m, if I wanted to go to a record store, I could.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
It's a little less like that now, I think, because record stores are less now. Yeah. But
I mean, you know, when we had a Virgin in at Disney property. But when Virgin started closing out, and I mentioned Virgin because Caesar's Palace had that giant Virgin. As soon as Virgin started closing out, which was probably like around 2001, same time, I was like, oh, things are changing, aren't they?
Yeah, yeah.
And I mean, Virgin, of course, it's still around, I guess, as an airline or whatever. But it really just kind of was, you know, the most like grandiose version of the media store, and there were so many weird things to find there. And I guess that's also why I have like a weird affection for places that clearly have nothing to give culturally other than like this capitalist you know, sunshine Mickey Mouse image, or you know, Vegas is kind of like the opposite in a way, but it's still very capitalist driven. But there's like a soul that is carved out of that labor,
yeah,
that I have kind of romanticized. I worked for a timeshare company,
yeah,
for like 8 years, not selling, because obviously no, but like just servicing things. And I remember just thinking that that was normal. And it hasn't been until I have lived here for 4 years doing what I actually like doing that I'm like, wow, you know, when you live in Vegas, when you live in Orlando, and those are the two cities that I consider kindred. Even Hollywood, I feel like, you know, it still has the myth. New right. York still has the myth. DC has politics.
Yeah, right.
Baltimore has being weird and beautiful. But Orlando and Vegas just really have like this nothing behind it that just have a lot of affection for. I can't describe it. Have you had any like celebrity moments with Beyond Video?
Well, I mean, it depends what you know, we have, like I said, the Baltimore music scene like is very special, and like guys from Future Islands, Beach House and Dan Deacon, I mean, they all come in here, and we had a lot of support as we were in the fundraising stage from mostly in signal boosting from John Waters as well.
I was going to say, has John stopped by? John, that was my way to ask.
John, I saw him about once a week in my years working at Video Marquee. He hasn't been in Beyond much, largely because, well, during COVID, I think, you know, John's removing himself from
right.
any exposure, I'm pretty sure. But he splits his time between four cities now. So
yeah,
he's not in the store every day the way he used to be when he was in Baltimore pretty much full time, you know.
So. Yeah, no, that's really beautiful. I don't think you know this either, because I try and keep my cool, but I've always been a huge fan of the Baltimore music scene.
Who are some of your favorites?
Beach House is literally, so you know, the Killers are my favorite band, but I would say Beach House is number three. I actually have a poster from when they played Jacksonville hanging in my house, and my first cat who was killed, she would freak out every single time I would play Beach House on the vinyl. And
freak out in what way?
Like, she would stretch out on the vinyl and start like pawing the air. And it was only for Beach House Records. And I have a video of it somewhere that I can't watch.
Cause like in a stretchy, like,
yeah,
this is good for me way. Okay,
yeah,
good.
Yeah.
Good.
She stand it. And then when she was killed, ironically enough, it was the week before they did the Dan Deacon Baltimore show, which I'm pretty sure is the last Baltimore tour they did. In 2019, no, right? At the theater? At the theater.
So Beach House did a... did Dan and Beach House play together?
Pretty sure.
There was the Windjammer thing, which was at the pier.
No.
And like everyone played that. Including, I think, Beach House and Dan both.
It was in June. It was June.
There was
17th.
So Beach House, the last show I think I saw. Well, I went up and saw them in Philly, and they played at the Meyerhoff here in town. I don't know that was Maybe it was with Dan. You know, I've seen both of them so many times. Okay, you got me.
Yeah. Humble brag here. No, because that was the first time I saw Dan, actually, even though I had been familiar with his music before. I think Dan does this for every one of his
Wait, you were up for the Baltimore show? Is that what
you
said? Yeah. Oh, okay.
Yeah, I drove. That's how much I stand.
Okay. I'm just saying, why didn't we meet back then? I guess we hadn't connected online
that
yet.
That was 4 months before I got down.
Okay. Well, you know your timeline. Yeah, you're totally right. I think that I had two different shows that I was trying to merge into this third show, which did happen. I can now. But yeah, I mean, it's different for me, not in my enjoyment because I'm awed by the music they make, but just because I'm friends with these guys, I see them more often and my memories are a little cluttered rather than distinct, you know?
No, it's like, I think I've told you this once. I think you have such a really remarkable way of attracting very passionate people around you, other than you yourself are a very passionate person. I think that's probably one of my favorite things about you. Because I think that that's kind of rare, you know, especially because some people, especially, you know, even in artist circles, kind of really like to make it about themselves. I just really love your energy.
I think that's one of the things that makes Baltimore special is that, and thank you for saying that. I appreciate that. But to try to generalize it about Baltimore, I mean, most of the people who are here love it. And people like, say, Beach House or Dan who could have moved to New York or LA or whatever.
Yeah.
They're here because they want to stay here. And they're people, even as they reach different levels of success, that are doing things because they want to see things happen. And that's, I think, the common ground I have with people. And obviously, I'm a music nut as well. But I just mean, if you're drawing a common thread between the Baltimore community and Beyond Video and you know, what I'm looking for in friends, it's people who are excited to do shit. And if it's making music and it sells a lot of records, great. But if it's like, you know, one of the guys from Animal Collective helped us build all the shelves here, you know, it's like, because he wanted to see Beyond Video happen and was willing to donate a day of his time to make it happen. So it's like, that's to me, what I want to see in other people, because a lot of things in life suck, you know?
Yeah, no.
I mean, and during a pandemic and a coup attempt, it's never more apparent, but like culture is what makes life worth living. I mean, it's on the short list, right? There's like 5 or 10 things.
Absolutely. And that's sort of, you know, I feel really lucky that I kind of have figured out a way to get paid for writing about that, because I can't, as I've grown older, I kind of sort of started out, you know, wanting to make my own stuff and then realizing, no, I don't want to make my own stuff. I want to tell people that there are ways that we can look at the beautiful efforts that people put into art and see what it teaches us about each other. And I feel like cinema really does that, which is why, you know, I find as much value in how important Star Wars is to people as Uncle Boon me.
Yeah, right.
You know, it's both extremely valid, which kind of, again, gets us back to horror home video.
Well, yeah, I mean, I think my perspective is probably, you know, being older, I remember like the big box VHS horror days.
Yeah.
And then I worked at Video Marquen first. Actually, my first time working in a video rental situation was at a Tower Records that had a small video rental component
to
it.
Right?
Yeah, Tower was one of the...
Kind of like FYE.
I mean, I would compare it to the experience you had with Virgin in that
I don't think we had a Tower Records.
Tower was one of the stores that kind of created the illusion of having everything. And even though it was a chain, they wanted, whether or not they succeeded, to feel like kind of like, you know, the cool chain, and had, you know, kind of tried to present a non-corporate kind of feel. And one thing that was really positive was that they gave the regional managers a lot of freedom, you know, so like the DC Tower Records would have tons of local hip hop and go-go and punk stuff, just like the truly indie record store would, because the manager was there because they loved music. And anyway, I worked in one that had a pretty banging VHS and Laserdisc collection. And during the brief Laserdisc moment,
do you have Laserdiscs right now? When I came in, you guys had a few, and I was like, amazing.
We have Laserdiscs. We have a small box of used Laserdiscs for sale for a dollar. We have a few Laserdiscs framed around the store. And then we also have these, I think they might be called UltraVision. And we have lots of those through the store. That is basically a gigantic floppy disk that holds a movie that was an alternative to VHS and Beta, like in the early 80s. So
what?
It's the same size as vinyl or Laserdisc, but it's actually a cartridge that produced a really unacceptable, horrific image.
Do you have access to a Laserdisc player?
Within the collective, we have some, you know, members who have them, but I don't have one currently.
Yeah, I don't think I've ever even seen a Laserdisc.
I'll show you one after we're recording. I mean, I'll show you. You mean you've never watched a film on a Laserdisc?
No, that's what I mean.
Yeah, gotcha. I did in college. I went to a small liberal arts college, and not a particularly special one, but so small and so not special that there was no film society when I arrived. So we did a kind of in the tiny theater in the library, a movie club that was on Laserdisc. And, you know, the main flaw of Laserdisc is you have to flip them halfway through.
Yeah.
You know, which, you know, is one of my favorite things about vinyl records, but least favorite things about Laserdisc, because you're not supposed to flip movies. But, you know, so we'd watch like half of Dazed and Confused or half of like a John Renoir film, and then I'd go back up into the booth and flip it, and then we'd see the second half. But yeah, so I guess what I'm getting at is, like, to me, horror home video is one of the things that has always been most exciting about video stores, as we think of them as portals and as we think of them as unlocking worlds. You know, when we think of the VHS era, nothing's as evocative as like one of those big box, you know, Possession or one of these movies that, you know, you're a kid staring at and you're like, this is forbidden fruit. I need, you know, I'm terrified of this, but I also need to taste it.
Yeah.
And as home video evolved in, you know, the late VHS era, you had like Anchor Bay putting out Argento and Fulci films and widescreen digitally remastered for the first time. And it was sort of an awakening for me that some movies that I had seen as kind of on VHS as kind of like grainy messes that were exciting and debaucherous actually had a real precise artistic vision to them that, you know, previous formats hadn't maybe honored.
And that's actually something that you and I really bonded, or what made me really bond to you, is that not only like was it like the memes, you were funny, but I think that you and I have the exact taste in horror films. Like, we have the same favorite horror film, Possession.
Yeah. That's my favorite film, period, I would say.
I would say, yeah. I have a strong attachment to Donnie Darko.
Yeah.
But Possession's probably second. Yeah. And I think it's because it's like you said, like, I really view horror as like an art, mm-hmm. right? Genre cinema as an art, which is kind of funny because, you know, especially I guess in whatever you would call like the hierarchy of Hollywood and what's considered highbrow, you know, genre cinema is thrown to the very bottom. And I know, like, and I'm not trying to trash these movies, and I'm not, but I know, like, in the last few years, you know, with Eggers films and Ari Aster, you know, the term elevated horror gets thrown around a lot. And I kind of hate it because I'm like...
horror was already elevated.
Exactly.
Yeah, I agree.
Exactly. And I guess we
I
can
do
talk
like
about
those
that.
Films, but I agree that that term is, you know, unintentionally, you know, has a pejorative aspect to it.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, and I think also when we're talking about home video as well, like, everyone, even if they have no interest in horror movies, should be thanking horror movie fans for keeping physical media alive.
Yeah.
I mean, the Blu-ray treatments that any film that, you know, you might be accessing and the best it's ever looked at home exists because horror and metal fans still spend money on physical media, basically.
They do.
Yeah.
Yeah. Which is kind of like, you get it. Like, sometimes I'm like, it's funny that it's like this thing, you know, even though like I see logically why. But I also just feel like, you know, it's funny. I started teaching my intro to film class this week, and I show them John Brigger, who, you know, has like this whole thing about like your surroundings affect how you watch and blah, blah, blah. And so I post that to them. And I remember that they were like, I can't get immersed at home. Like I can't get into films at home unless it's a horror movie, because horror movies are more personal, more intimate, and they scare me more. And I was like, I mean, that's valid though, you know, and that's sort of how, like, I mean, the home video craze in the 80s is kind of what saved the horror genre, you know?
Yeah. I also think that, speaking to that experience that some of your students are having, I mean, if a horror movie's working, it takes over your house. The house hasn't taken over the movie, because you're scared that you're not safe in a way, you know, you're safe, but not safe in your own space.
Yeah.
And if a horror movie is really working its magic on you. So, you know, I try to push back, because I think on the idea of immersive film experiences, because I think during COVID, we've all had opportunities to, you know, watch Satan Tango or whatever, you know, Berlin Alexanderplatz or whatever it is we were making excuses for not having watched before. You know, not everyone has oodles of free time. That's not fair to all workers. But like, you know, if you're a living like I am, like mostly unemployed but stable and healthy, and you have, you know, a Blu-ray player, like, you know, put your phone away for a little while, put your iPad away for a little while, and actually breathe in the relief of there being no push notifications and no Donald Trump and all these other things in your field of vision for a couple hours.
Did you watch Host on Shudder yet?
Yeah, I did watch Host.
What did you think?
I thought it was cool. did you love it? Or
I love your joke. I thought it was cool.
You know, I haven't really deeply scrutinized it, because I think it was built up a little too much for me.
Oh, that sucks. I hate that.
Yeah.
As soon as people mention movies I haven't seen, I'm like, stop talking. You're just going to ruin it.
But no, I was, you know, it was, for the moment, there was probably no scarier movie. I mean, because, you know, we're all living our lives on Zoom, and then all of a sudden it's taking over our headphones and computer screen that way.
Right. You run the Beyond Video social media, right?
Well, I run the Twitter, and I co-run the Instagram.
Okay. Were you talking to me about Possessor?
I probably.
Okay, cool. Yeah. So I think this was only about a week ago, because you guys received Possessor, right?
Oh, yeah. So Possessor, I think I probably would have said that, like, I enjoyed it, but, like, I really wish I had
you
created
me,
a more immersive experience for that.
That's literally what you said, because you said that you watched it on a laptop. And so 3 days later, I watched it on my TV. but it's funny that you mentioned that, because I was like, no, I got to watch on something bigger. You know, it's actually one of my investments that I did in quarantine. I bought a projector screen.
Yeah, I have that too. And, you know, I think Possessor was one that should have been, you know, beamed up on that rather than, you know, I was like, let me have a fun time with my laptop here, and, you know, didn't follow my own advice with that.
I feel like it was underwhelming, but I feel like, especially with horror, I never know how I feel about a horror film until like 3 days later. Like Host, I feel like paid off really well in the moment. And then 3 days later, I'm like, well, that was fun.
Yeah.
And you know, kind of leave it at that. But Possessor is one where I'm like, man, it had some really stark imagery. And I think that's actually something that's very in common with the movies that we like. Another one of your favorites is Angst, which is 1984.
So are we talking about Angst or Anguish?
Anguish. Sorry.
Yeah. Anguish is probably.
That's the chick and the dude. England?
And there's the movie theater within the movie. Are we talking?
No,
oh,
we're
you're
not
talking about Angst then.
Okay, we are talking about Angst.
So Angst is the Home Invasion movie.
I thought you said Angst was one of your favorites. Am I crazy?
I probably would have said Anguish.
I got that confused.
Yeah. But well, I could easily have said Angst too. I mean, the titles are really similar.
It was one of those things where I was just stalking your Instagram, and I watched it after you had recommended it.
I also do like Angst, but there are multiple titles by that. So you describe Angst to me, and I'll tell you what
Angst,
I think
yeah,
about
no,
it.
Yeah, no, I remember it started with a British dude. I think it's a home invasion movie. You're right. But it's like a dude and a woman. And I remember it being the 80s. I remember it being non-American. What is Anguish? I don't think I've ever heard of Anguish.
Anguish is, I might be saying their name wrong, but Vigas Luna. And okay. It's from like 86 or 87. There's a really terrifying eyeball scene, but it also, the movie that's terrifying you then is kind of pulled back and you're also watching people watch that in a movie theater and then horrible things happen to them as well.
Have you seen Black Bear yet?
Yeah, I did the Aubrey Platt. Yeah.
What'd you think of it?
I dug it. I was pretty. I mean, in a lot of ways, it lives or dies on her performance, right? And I thought,
oh my
she
god,
was awesome,
it does. So, yeah.
What about yourself?
I've watched a lot of movies, and a huge part thanks to your newsletter, because I do. I give you like $3 a month, and it's great. It's best $3 of my life. but you recommend a lot of really great things. Like, you know, I've watched a lot of things on Kino Marquee because of things that you've recommended. I think the last thing that I watched that you recommended was His House and Ham on Rye, His House was interesting.
Yeah.
But Ham on Rye, I saw. But anyway, Black Bear, I would have never watched it otherwise, I think, had it not been for that last year. And it's one of those things where I'm like, I'm not sure if I like the movie, but I liked the experience.
Yeah.
Which I also kind of, again, goes back to horror home video. And honestly, I would write the article that Black Bear is a horror film, even though I don't think it has ever been argued as such. I'm like, I could see, this is just totally like this.
I kind of imagine that, the director, Lawrence, you know, had made some sort of like mumblecore stuff earlier, relationship comedy, but they always had a dark spin to them. And him and Sophia Takal, who's his partner and made Always Shine, like they are very much moving into horror. I think she made the Black Christmas remake more recently.
Oh, really?
Yeah. So I think that in their head, it's probably, I imagine, and I haven't talked to him about it, but I imagine Larry conceived it as kind of like a horror, dark comedy kind of thing.
Yeah.
To me, like the claustrophobia of that film is similar to like maybe a little bit Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf, but also like Her Smell, the Alex Ross Perry, Elizabeth Moss film. And, you know, what's more horrifying than a person, you know, just completely dominating the people around them with their own neuroses and needs and games, you know,
and having that, yeah, and having that,
that's even a horror most of us have experienced.
Yeah. And I think that's yet another thing that we have a lot in common with, is kind of like that liberal definition of horror, because people don't realize that horror is kind of like, you know, in the perspective of the beholder, right? Like I teach a lot of race and horror in my class, and I tell them, you know, like maybe a white American may not consider The Birth of a Nation a horror film, but to Black Americans and certain non-white Americans, that's a horror film.
Yeah.
But, you know, it doesn't have to just be about race. As you said, it's a lot about, you know, like the consciousness and things like that. And I kind of almost have more fun trying to apply the horror genre to viewership experiences. I feel like it's sort of like an underrated or underlooked at viscerality, you know?
Yeah, I agree with that.
Yeah.
No, I'm all for that liberal definition, and also for, you know, talking about things without definition unless they're useful, you know?
Yeah, so exactly. Like,
genres and are useful in a record store or in a video store, because things need to be organized in some way that's not just A to Z, right? But you know, you need to be able to tell a person it's in this section, go find it. You know, that's just part of navigating a physical space. But the place a movie is assigned, whether it's a drama or a comedy, and it has nothing to do with whether or not the viewer has a horrific experience watching it, or whether it speaks to things they've experienced or things they fear they may experience.
Absolutely. Sort of related to that, just because I meant to ask you this, and now I'm just curious, how did you decide to organize the store as you did? I know that you have a team, so it probably wasn't a tyrannical decision, but like you said, there's like new release sections and things like that, but the second floor especially has like, some of it is directors, but then some of it is like Criterion and things like that, and it's just kind of like, I have a panic attack thinking about how I would organize
it. Yeah. Well, I mean, in a lot of ways, we ported over the organization of Video American, because both of us as workers here, most of us did work there. I was a manager there for like 6 years. But also we knew a lot of our customers would remember that organization. Our organization by director isn't entirely us subscribing to like auteur theory or something like that, although, you know, we do think about directors as primary creators in a lot of
senses.
There's
an auteur section, right?
I mean, we have a just a room that's, the walls are by director, you know, we informally call it the Great Director's Wall. But I think part of that is us knowing and remembering from Video American that Director's Wall create this collision of experience that's really fascinating. Like, if you're in the room for a Elaine May movie and Lucretia Martel's next door, you may never have heard of one or the other, but these films are spilling over into each other's sections and you start becoming aware of them.
Yeah.
And if you're just looking for a drama, that doesn't happen as organically. And on the director's wall, there's films from, you know, every country and every era and every genre that are next to each other because, you know, John Ford and Fassbender are near each other and Abel Ferrara is in the mix there. And, you know, it's just, you know, you become more voracious and more curious because you're seeing things you might not otherwise be exposed to.
Yeah. So what is like the typical, like, you think of your average Beyond Video customer, you know, regular, do they actively ask you for help, or do you feel like it's more of a personal thing?
I mean, lots of people do ask for recommendations, which is, you know, exciting on both ends, because that's what we wanted the space to be, like a conversational space. I think that a lot of the younger people who are, you know, not as far on their voyage tend to ask questions and, you know, like, what's the Godard film to start with, or, you know,
what do you tell them?
Oh man, for Godard.
And why is it Alphaville? No, I'm kidding.
Yeah. I mean, I
talking about
painted myself
movie
into a corner, because that's I would have to really zoom in on what that person's idea of Godard is and what they were looking, you know, whether they're looking
it's
for
kind of a joke,
Breathless or I do get asked what's, you know, a lot of people want to explore Fassbender, for instance, and don't know where to start, and that's a question that comes up an awful lot. Or there were a lot of people who got more into horror this year because they had more free time in October than they'd ever had before. But what I'm trying to say is that people who are kind of new to, you know, considering themselves cinephiles tend to ask a lot of questions. And then people who are very far along their journey and have very specific questions, like, I'm really into, you know, chilly mid-60s British movies like Seance on a, you know, Wet Afternoon, what's another film like that, you know, where they feel like they can ask someone on the other end of the counter a super specific question about a wormhole of feeling or content that they're not even sure there's another film. But if anyone knows the answer, it's going to be someone who works at Beyond Video.
And, you know, With that answer, I think you really awaken a feeling in me that, again, I find very relatable. And please correct me if I'm wrong, but I feel like, especially when you want to work in the film industry, whatever that means, you know, you're kind of usually pressured to, like, be on set or be, you know, be a director, be a writer and whatnot and blah, blah, blah. And it took me a long time to realize that, oh, I don't have to do those things, but I want to be with people experiencing movies. I want to know what they like. I want to try and learn how to watch for the things that they watch. And then even in my classes, you know, I always tell them, I'm not here to like, teach you the history. I'm here to show you that there are different ways to look at films. And that's what I hope you leave with in this class. And I feel like you share that spirit a lot. And I feel like, especially to keep Beyond Video running and running happily, or I guess as happy as it can be, right? You need to kind of have that passion and kind of not have that ego. And yeah, I guess, like, did you ever feel like you really wanted to make your own stuff, or you want to make your own stuff, or has always been like, I just want to talk about movies, which is how I feel.
Yeah, that's more how I feel too. I mean, I don't want to be a film director. Like, I know a lot of film directors from programming Maryland Film Festival for a number of years, and I don't have the disposition, you know, like, I am a workaholic, but I'm a workaholic because I'm trying to get to a point where I've cleared my to-do list and I can enjoy myself. I'm not, right. I do have in my life, but I don't want 100 different people bothering me at once with Buck Stop Here answers. I mean, from programming a film festival, I know I hate that. I'm trying to work to make something happen, not because I want, you know, to be the guy everyone has to ask how to do their job or whatever. And that's what a film director is. And music, which I love just as much as film, I have very little, you know, I've gotten to be, you know, perfunctory, semi-capable on piano at one point in my life. But, like, obviously not a path to me being able to do that.
Ditto.
But
I had a guitar and I learned, like, one song. And then I was like, this is not for me.
Yeah. I mean, I wish they were in a way, but when you describe the no ego, it's just because those aren't ambitions of mine. You know, my ambition is to have an excited conversation about how we both love something, or we have an interesting disagreement about this thing we both experience.
Yeah, ditto. And I think that that's really beautiful. And I think that especially a lot of times when people even go to like film school or whatnot, there's like that pressure. And it's just kind of like, no, you can just figure out a way of how to make talking about movies or curating movies, or even, you know, because what you're doing here in a way is sort of like a DIY Library of Congress kind of thing. Like, I wish that our government had, you know, these incentives to care about the, you know, art in a way. And our government never has. And it kind of comes down to like a community kind of thing. And that's it. Again, it makes it more beautiful than things like Blockbuster or for-profit video stores, because it comes from the heart. Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, I think that I do sometimes use the word, I mean, certainly library is appropriate. When you look at like something like Library of Congress, it's like, you know, we're not strictly speaking an archive because, yeah, we don't have film prints here. We don't have hard drives here. We don't have the source here. But what we have, so even if it's a copy of the thing, in some ways, it might be more alive than the thing, because the Library of Congress is, you know, deep in Virginia. Their film library is massive and extensive, and they do have public screenings, but they're not really in an area that's accessible to too many people.
Yeah.
Whereas here, you know, we have 18,000 movies that someone could come in and take whichever one most excites them home at any moment, you know, and that's more alive than a lot of archives and more accessible than a lot of archives.
John Berger would say that the reproduction is more alive than the original, because the original needs the context that's mystified. But once you reproduce something and bring it to the people, you demystify the prestige around it, and that's more magical. And I believe in that.
Yeah, no, that is a really insightful take on it. And, you know, hopefully we're experientially offering that here.
Yeah, no, you definitely are. And like I said, I really like this area, and I posted right before walking in, but this is just my favorite building probably in Baltimore, just because I feel the outside is so beautiful, which you've told me before what the outside was based on, but I want you to say it yourself.
Well, it was designed by a team, Post Topography, which is Bruce Willen and Nolan Strauss, who I also brought in to do the Maryland Film Festival posters. And I think even as I don't have a great relationship with that organization, I think they still do the posters there. So
they're welcome.
Yeah, they did a, you know, building size mural. That's a swirl that's supposed to represent both some of the iconography of like a home video remote control, but also the sense of, you know, the infinite, you know, preservation of this thing that wasn't supposed to exist anymore.
I remember, I think the first time that I asked you about it, I immediately was like, it's a Twin Peaks reference, right? And you were like, not really, but maybe. And then I think maybe you said this, or maybe this came later on to me, but it's also even like a Vertigo Hitchcockian
kind of thing. Definitely. And I don't know. I mean, I'm a big Twin Peaks nut, but when we were talking to Bruce and Nolan years and years ago, because they made the design for, you know, our branding well before we even had this space.
Oh, really?
Yeah. So
it's beautiful too. Like even the logo with the, because one of, I think the E or the O is spiraled too, right?
Yeah, the O is. Yeah.
Yeah. It's beautiful and really simple. And I'm going to say zany, which I know sounds like dumb, but in a good way, in a zany, cute way.
Yeah, I mean, I also like, this is kind of a tangent, but I was wondering whether it would be too bold for the neighborhood because, like, have you ever
in
seen
Baltimore?
Well, you know, it was when it was the Reptilian Records, it was a green exterior that was kind of puke green and over time, but every one of the other row houses here has a solid color look. Yeah. And I was a little wondering, you know, are we going to be too flashy?
I mean, what are they going to do, egg? I don't understand.
Well, everyone's been really cool about it. I mean, and actually enjoys it. But I was thinking about it similarly to the when the Beatles opened their Apple store in London in the 60s. If you've ever seen that, it's like just the scale of making a row house that looks residential into, you know, a branded thing can look really attention grabbing in ways that are positive and negative. And this has been wholly positive.
Yeah.
But because I initially had a fear that it might be too bold.
The indoors, I mean, the ceilings are black and the walls are white. It's just really beautiful. It's such an aesthetically pleasing space to be in.
Yeah. And it's, you know, the exterior is so professional and beautiful, and the interior is more of like a handcrafted beauty and like a flawed beauty, you know, because most of the people who are building it, you know, it might have been the first time we held a hammer in like 5 years, you know.
Oh, man. Okay. Well, I guess we should begin to wrap up. I do want to ask a couple of 2020 questions. Just kind of, I kind of prepped you for this before, but I'm going to ask now. What would you say was your favorite release period last year?
Yeah, good question. I mean, I think one of my favorite films that doesn't get talked about enough is Manos, which can be seen. I mean, it's a very visceral thriller that definitely, you know, in line with our conversation earlier, could be seen as a horror film.
Yeah.
Did you see that one or?
I didn't. I don't think I've even heard of it. What is it?
I would put that, towards the top of your list. I think it was shot in Colombia. I'm not entirely sure, but it's a Latin American film about some like almost like Harmony Korine-esque child soldiers who have to keep track of a cow, and they also have a prisoner, and then it turns into kind of like a jungle almost Herzogian, you know, kind of thing, but with horror and thriller elements.
Oh, where'd you watch it?
It played at the Charles Theater just before quarantine started, but we also have it on Blu-ray here.
Oh, nice. Yeah. What was the last movie you saw in theaters?
The very last movie I saw, that question just really shook me. The last movie I saw, well, I was at the True False Film Festival in Missouri.
Which you're drinking your tumbler out of.
Yeah. Yeah, it's my favorite film festival these days. But I was there while the news came that South by Southwest had to cancel. Yeah. And like, it was the moment when it went from this vague, oh, maybe this is going to affect us, to like, oh, there's a pandemic here.
Yeah.
The last film I saw was the closing night film of that festival, which was Kirsten Johnson's Dick Johnson is Dead, which is the documentary she made with her father. That's sort of a playful film, as he does have a diagnosis of I don't know if it's Alzheimer's or dementia, but he is in a slight state of decline. But he participated in a film where he dies over and over again on camera.
Oh, wow.
As a way for her, she's primarily a cinematographer. She made the film Camera Person that is part of the Criterion Collection. But this film is just her and her dad kind of mutually coming to terms with the fact that his life may end soon.
Yeah.
And doing it with like humor and intersections of real life and sort of creative nonfiction.
Yeah.
And it was awesome. And I think Netflix owns it, so it's very accessible to people. Dick Johnson is Dead.
Oh, really? That's interesting. I remember your post about it, actually, and writing. I almost remember that post almost to the word, because it was one of my first things where I was like, oh, I guess this may be like lasting longer. Mine isn't as exciting. I saw The Invisible Man.
I wish I'd seen that on theater. I loved Upgrade, his film, just prior to that. So
really?
I
had not seen it. Yeah. And if I had liked them, I remember I was going to be like, if I like this, I'll watch that one. And that didn't happen.
I would recommend Upgrade. I mean, Upgrade is, a throwback to like a RoboCop or First Terminator kind of sense of horror science fiction.
You're not going to call me an idiot because you're too nice, but I'm going to call myself an idiot. I just watched the Star Wars movies for the very first time. Mm-hmm. And I was like, oh, wow,
you
get it.
You fucking idiot. No. It's like, you hadn't seen any of them before? Or?
I had never seen any of the original. That's a lie. In film school, they show you A New Hope, and I fell asleep during it.
Sure.
I watched Phantom Menace when it first came out. Didn't remember it. I did watch A Force Awakens. But I was just like, you know what? I'm going to give it a try. And at the end of it, I was like, oh, I get the appeal. But I mentioned that because when I saw the first Terminator, also only about like 5 years ago, I was like, this is a really good movie.
Yeah. I mean, because the Terminator franchise has become such a...
what it is.
Yeah. People forget that the first one was... I mean, calling it a B movie isn't accurate, but it was...
It's visceral.
Yeah, it's visceral and dark, and it was...
I mean, he's like walking down this like, it's like, you know, something that you would see out of John Wick now with like this like synth soundtrack, you know, right? And I was just like, this is beautiful, you know, and actually I was talking to this with my kids the other day. I was like, you know, I feel like great action films aren't made anymore because I don't think superhero films, I think, would be considered action films now. I don't think that that's like a thing, you know, like.
Not in Hollywood too much, although I do kind of like the John Wick movies. But
I was going to say John Wick films, I feel like, are the only ones, because even like in Hollywood, John Wick is like sort of considered art housey, which, okay.
Yeah. I mean, I can see that characterization. I think that, it's one of those places where sort of alternative culture and mainstream culture intersect, right? Because it's at the multiplex, but it kind of has a cult following.
Right.
But I would highly recommend Upgrade then. I mean, Upgrade is, you know, it's an action sci-fi film for people who like RoboCop and Starship Troopers and that kind of Verhoeven era. So
Beautiful. And I guess the last question, so you posted the list of top rentals for 2020 up on Twitter and Instagram. So y'all should check that out. But I did ask you to find the top horror rental from last year. And so
For the year.
Or actually the whole, all time.
I mean, our top renting movie of all time, you know, when we say all time, we've been open, you know, 2 years and 2 months. So it's not the entirety of human history, not quite. But our top rating movie, period, is Mandy. And I would expect that
really?
That was, yeah, yeah. I mean, part of the reason for that is because it was a new release soon after Beyond Video first opened.
That's
that
true.
I either hadn't played Baltimore theatrically or, you know, people hadn't, its reputation hadn't really preceded it.
Right.
So people, there was a lot of, you know, the same way there's sort of love them or hate them, a cachet and coolness around the A24, you know, so-called elevated horror we discussed earlier.
Right.
Mandy had that too.
Yeah.
But was even more inaccessible to people. So I don't mean
Do you like Mandy?
I do like Mandy. Yeah.
Do you like it? Like you saw Beyond the Black Rainbow, right?
Yeah. I saw Beyond the Black Rainbow twice. And the first time I saw it, I was underwhelmed by it. And the second time it really clicked with me.
Mm.
The second time was after I saw Mandy. And I mean, the first time I watched Beyond the Black Rainbow, I was struck by, it felt like all the scenes of building tension and like staying up too late in the 80s or early 90s, watching like HBO or a video that you were a little too young to,
to,
you know,
see,
accept
yeah.
the horror, you know?
Yeah.
And it felt like all the building tension scenes and none of the release of those movies. And I think maybe that is what it is. And that's kind of a wonderful thing for a film to be. And, and maybe the first time I was confounded by it, and the second time I really embraced it. Whereas Mandy, you know, is 1 hour of buildup and then a second hour of like complete over the top ludicrous release. And, you know, as the kids say, I was there for it. But what about you? I want to hear your Mandy take.
Oh, man. I respect that dude's vibe a lot. And I think I like Black Rainbow more because I was less distracted by the elements in the sense that the elements being Nick Cage. And I have strong feelings about Andrea Riseborough's face.
Okay. Strong positive feelings?
No.
Got it.
I like the Black Mirror episode she did. But otherwise, like every single time she's, and I felt this during Possessor, but for Possessor kind of worked because she's that like weird brain hacker thing that I still don't understand the science. I liked Possessor, but it was one of those things where I was like, the science is throwing me off.
Yeah. I think we're both going to click with that movie on the second viewing, maybe.
You're bold in thinking I'll watch it a second time. No, I'm kidding. Mandy, I guess like I walked in expecting balls to the wall. And when the first hour was like just a really long slow motion shot and then the second hour caught up, I was like, well, okay. I don't hate it, but I haven't watched it again. You know, one thing that I think is really interesting about it is that it's one of the few recent films that does midnight screenings.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm like, why?
Yeah.
And like of all the movies that have come out in the last like 10 years, what was so special about this one? And I would read an article on it.
Yeah, that would be really fascinating. I mean, to me,
because DC, the Landmark, E Street, before the pandemic, it would do weekly midnight screenings of that effing movie.
Oh, that's really interesting.
Mm-hmm.
I tried to do midnight screenings when I was programming the Parkway Theater here, and like,
were
they
successful?
I mean, they were great experiences, but attendance was not great. And I think part of that might be just Baltimore and like residual feelings, even though I don't want to, you know.
Okay.
people have perceptions that Baltimore is not safe, and there's truth and untruth to that perception.
Yeah.
But even for people who live here, I don't think there's a lot of people who like starting a movie
right
at midnight is like necessarily in their comfort level. I think that was
right.
part of it.
That actually, this wasn't going to be a question I asked, but you kind of reminded me of it. So I guess we'll end here. If you could tell me about your favorite movie theater experience, and I guess it doesn't, like, if it's a drive-in, that's fine. Just your favorite general cinema going experience ever. Do you think you have one?
Wow. Yeah. I mean, I'm such a nut for old theaters. So part of it, you know, is exploring historical theatrical spaces. And I don't know if I could just pinpoint one.
One of my things to do on my bucket list is to see a movie in CinemaScope, I think. Mm-hmm. I know that there's special theaters in California that have the three projectors.
Oh, the Cinerama.
There you go. Cinerama. That's like on my bucket list.
I have not done that. I mean, one of the moments I felt, my eureka moment with film festivals was, and I've written about this and you may or may not have read it, but the first Toronto Film Festival I went to was actually a bonus for Video American managers that the owner sent us on.
That's cute.
And so me and actually one of the people who was part of the trip was Sean Williams, who's the DP of several of the Safdie brothers movies, and Alex Ross Perry's. Yeah. We were are still, but you know, at the time we're Baltimore buds. He's a citizen of the world now.
He's famous.
Yeah, exactly. But we, you know, we went and saw 12 movies in 2 days because, you know, it was just a 24-hour or 48-hour trip, and we walked the streets of Toronto all night, you know, after a midnight movie to line up for a 9 a.m. movie. And just,
oh, wow.
I just realized, and, you know, one of them I think might have been My Best Fiend, introduced by Werner Herzog in person,
you know.
And now Toronto's very expensive, but at the time the tickets were like $10 Canadian, which was like
$5.
$5 or $6. Yeah. And I was just like, why am I not always doing this? And
then I know.
Now I found out why. but that was one of the more special moments. And I, also, one time I was just in a San Francisco and they happened to be doing their film noir film festival at the Castro. And
wow.
I think that unified kind of my love of like the dark corners of film history and with a space that is part of that history as well.
Yeah, because that's another thing we also have in common. We like foreign films. I mean, I just think you and I just love cinema, no matter where it's from, no matter who does it. We would watch anything just to say it. But I also have a deep love for like that classic, you know, Hollywood, like the, it's just, you know, it's beautiful in a different way. I love that you said the one where you all just like stayed up watching movies.
Yeah, yeah.
I think that's great because I used to dress up a lot for midnight screenings, which is what got me thinking of it, because it's sort of absurd that midnight screenings were ever a thing.
Yeah.
Because even before the pandemic, you know, I think the trend now is that things premiere at 7 p.m. on Thursday night instead of just waiting until midnight, which makes a lot more sense.
Right.
That should have always been the case. But I think in like, what was it? Like 2000 to 2010, it was like a rite of passage. And I was in
my... So you're talking about like an emerging Hollywood film, you would go to it
1201
Thursday/Friday. Got it.
The crazy, and I'm not too proud it's for these films because it was just, you know, the people I was hanging out with at the time, but probably the most extreme I ever did was I dressed up as Eartha Kitt's Catwoman.
Okay.
And it was for the final Christopher Nolan Batman film, I guess The Dark Knight Rises. And we watched, so it was like a marathon thing. It started at 8 p.m. And it was, so I guess it was like Batman Begins, The Dark Knight, and then The Dark Knight Rises. But then there was an encore that played at 3 a.m. And my best friend at the time, she was just a crazy fan. She was like, let's stay until 6. So I stayed from like 8 p.m. to 6 a.m. at this. And in Orlando, all of our major movie theaters are in theme parks.
Okay.
So it was at the Universal the Universal AMC. Also at the Universal AMC, I did all of the Harry Potter films.
Oh, yeah, yeah, totally.
But I think like cinema going experience in Orlando, actually, we have a drive-in theater about 30 minutes away, but like a real drive-in theater, because I notice in this area, y'all call drive-in theaters that are not drive-in theaters.
Well, we have an actual drive-in, Benji's, that's been around. what are you gonna what's your criteria here?
I'll give Baltimore that credit, because I think I knew that that one existed, but there was something about it that kind of threw me off. I felt like it was too modern, because the one
it's been around since the 50s and is a real historic drive-in.
It's interesting. So ours is called Silver Moon Drive-In. Tickets are $5 per car. Concession stands are like $3 for popcorn and whatnot. And it just legit had always felt like stepping into time without feeling like I'm going to get attacked. And I feel like it's only now that I've moved out of Florida that I realized that that's kind of more of a rare experience. Because I think the one that you're thinking of, I looked it up and I was like, oh, all the prices are normal.
You mean like normal movie theater?
Movie theater prices. No, but Benji's is more legit. But I think in where I live in Northern Virginia, like Woodbridge area, they've been turning the Alamos into drive-in theaters.
Like during COVID.
And I think also the Angelica DC is considered a drive-in theater now. And, you know, all the power to making things accessible. Like, I'm not saying stop it, you're trash. What I'm saying is that you're not a drive-in theater.
No, I think that's just those chains and Hollywood together still trying to find a way to show emerging films in this pandemic. But yeah, those aren't real drive-ins. For sure.
Does Benji's allow you to take in food?
So part of what makes Benji's a real drive-in is that the owner is a sort of beloved lunatic, and he will shine a flashlight in you and ban you for life if he sees any candy that you snuck in, unless you pay basically like a uncorking fee where you can bring in your own candy if you give him, I can't remember what it is, but a couple bucks.
I think that was exactly it. That was my problem.
Well, it's not ideal. I would love to sneak. I mean, I've gone there and drank. I don't want to be banned for life, but like people do sneak things in there, but it's a risk.
No, what I was going to say is Silver Moon, actually, the one that I grew up with, encourages it.
Yeah.
So my favorite thing, and I feel comfortable saying this, students, don't repeat my behavior. My favorite thing that I did from like ages 15 to 25 is I would bring in every kind of drug. Every kind of alcohol.
Yeah.
And I'd be like, we're staying here for 6 hours. And it was magical. I got to say, like, that was my Florida trash moment.
Yeah. Well, I want to reiterate for the students, it's only safe to do that at a real drive-in.
Go down to Lakeland. It's open. Okay. Well, Eric, I could be here all night. I don't want to take up.
No, I'm fine. I can keep going as long as you want. But I also know, like, things... You know, all things must pass, as George Harrison said. Yeah.
I follow your mayor on Instagram.
Oh, yeah, because he's great.
Yeah, he's great. And he posted this crab cake a few days ago. And I've never had a crab cake in my life. So that's what I'm going to do after this.
That's awesome. I've only had one in my life because I...
Really?
I became vegetarian when I was like 16. And I realized... I'd eaten a lot of crab, but not had a crab cake for some reason when I was 15 or 16. So I ordered one knowing like in a couple weeks, this will be verboten by my own, whatever, quizzical moral code. They should be savory rather than sweet for sure.
Good.
But yeah,
I don't want something sweet in my mouth. All right. No, but thank you so much for doing this.
Oh, my pleasure. It's,
I actually hope this isn't the last time we do this.
I'd love to be back. Yeah.
So much. Warmth in my heart.
Aw, awesome. Me too. And thank you for
and this is
not
our
only
first...
having me, but coming up all this way to
It was worth it for the company.
Yeah.
But I'm genuinely, I feel like I was here from the beginning because I love this whole idea just so much. And I just wish that people had the inspiration to do this themselves, you know, where they live. And I hope that, you know, this kind of inspires someone. You never know, right?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, we largely built this collection by having people, you know, it was crowdsourced, you know, people just gave us DVDs they didn't want. And we did the work of, you know, trying to keep, you know, kind of Noah's Ark it and have one of everything, you know?
Yeah.
And people are, it's a perfect moment to try to do something like this because people think DVDs are trash. They don't know that they're actually, you know, these portals into magical worlds.
Yeah, no, they really are. It's so magical. I'm just thinking of it now. All right. Well, thank you, Eric. Thank you, everyone, for listening. And I guess we're going to robot out of here.
Thank you so much. And thanks, everyone, for listening.